It is time for another journey deep into the lining of the magical talking hat. Hat wranglers Tony and William reach into the yawning chasm that is the hat and pull forth the questions you have posed. Will they tire of your question quickly? Is your name Azhatalin? Then perhaps they will, but then perhaps not. But that will remain a mystery until we venture into the magical talking hat.
All right, let me ask you a question. If you heard that someone was body doubling for someone else, what do you think that means?
Well, one of two things.
Okay. You're one more than I had, so.
Sometimes famous people will do it, like in public appearances and things like that. But mm-hmm. also in film, it might be done if an actor doesn't want to do a particular scene, usually a sex scene or something like that.
Yeah.
And they'll replace, you know, someone else will come in and do the scene where their face isn't going to be seen or whatever. Those are the two things I can think of.
And there are versions where it's just that this person is too important and we don't see their face. But the most common one is this scene requires nudity. I don't want to do nudity. Pay a random person who's vaguely shaped like me to do the nudity.
Right.
What I understood. I guess it is true that famous people will sometimes do a body double out in public and things.
Politicians, like things like that. Yeah.
I think well known. I mean, I think there's actually an erotic thriller movie out of the 80s called Body Double for like this exact kind of thing. Like, whatever. So imagine my surprise the other day when a friend of mine said the previous weekend she had been body doubling for a different friend of hers. For the record, none of these people are in show business or particularly famous. Or look like anyone particularly famous.
Or look like each other? I mean, or do they at least...
Well, I don't know. I haven't actually met the other friend. But okay. As far as I know, no.
Okay.
So yeah, I was confused. And so I asked my friend, what the fuck are you talking about? And she explained to me what she was talking about. It was not either of the things we said here. Okay. And it was actually something with which I am quite familiar. It is a process that is becoming a very common, helpful tool in the world of people with ADHD. But it is something I have made use of, and it's something Trish has made use of. And actually, I do this for Trish often. It is a thing where people who have trouble focusing on a task will have another person there, often just sort of to sort of chat or whatever, but their presence will keep them focused and they are unlikely to just start wandering off and doing something else or just like taking a break because there's a person there who also knows what they're trying to do, and just having that presence can help. Trish has used me in this capacity in many times where she has like, there's a bunch of laundry I need to fold. It's been building up for weeks. I just need to get it done. But every time I start, you know, something distracts me or I get sick of it or whatever. Can you just be in the room with me and just sort of chat while I'm doing it? You don't have to fold any laundry, but just chat and I'll do it. And I do that for her sometimes. I use this technique just after college when I was still living in Grinnell. One of my best friends was also living in Grinnell. And one day we were both complaining about how ridiculously trashed both our apartments were. And how we would try to clean, but like we didn't know where to start. And like frequently we would give up really quick. So we get this idea. And one weekend I went to his apartment and I helped some, but mostly I was just there to keep him focused. And it took, you know, most of the day, but afterwards his apartment was gorgeous. And then the next weekend he came over and did the same for me. This is a lovely, brilliant little bit of social engineering that can be very helpful in helping people focused on tasks. And I love that my friend has figured this out and is making use of this with their friend and all this. Supposedly, according to my friend, the ADHD community has termed it body doubling. And so I never thought I'd have to say this, but ADHD community, you are wrong. And you should feel bad. That's a terrible thing to call it. First of all, as we've established, already a thing. In some cases, kind of an off-color thing. But second of all, what? How would that even be? Let's pretend that phrase didn't exist. How does that work here? In the sense that double refers to two, and there are two bodies present, I guess, but no. So ADHD community, you have failed. Give up now. Move on. So,
well, what would you call it then?
Hello, everyone. Welcome to that's my version of no more questions. This interview is over. Welcome to. I'm gonna start doing that. I'm gonna be ask you a question, and you'll be like, "What?" And I'll be like,
ah! "I love it. I love it."
Welcome to the Magical Talking Hat podcast, the only podcast in the world that is rebooting this fall with younger actors and starting from the beginning. So we're going to start like the first episode. There will be some script changes to adjust for, you know, modern sensibilities, but it's going to be the same storyline, just with younger, you know, Gen Z actors. Whatever. I'm Tony, playing the character of Tony for now.
And I'm William. And this is episode 636.
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if the new William is gonna, or if it's Wilhelmina. I don't know.
Yeah, right. Maybe we can play around with that. You know,
they don't have to be white people. They can
colorblind casting. Maybe. People are in the comments like, "It's not a race thing. Historically, Tony and William have always been white. Why is it such a big deal?"
Yeah, I mean, we go lots of ways with it.
You can't make female podcasters. They're just not a thing. If you delve into the lore, it's not a thing.
Delve into the lore.
One of the most envious days I ever had was the day I found out that the McElroy brothers have there's a wiki about them and their podcast that they didn't create or have anything to do with. This is there, and I'm like, oh man, on a wiki. I don't even want it to be true. I just want people to write weird shit about us. For those of you just joining us, don't get used to it. We're going to be recast soon. We have a hat, and it's magical in that it has its own email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. And people like to write into that email address, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com, with little notes, comments, questions, topics, whatever they feel like. I actually just realized recently, I'm going to stop. I used to say manifestos or diatribes. I'm going to stop saying that because very seldom, and we didn't really talk about it, there have been emails that we have opted not to make use of because we thought they would be problematic and or triggering, and or they were triggering for one or both of us. And in all of those instances, I would say they definitely qualify as a manifesto or a diatribe. So I think, not to dip into this well too often, but I think I'm going to use the old McElroy brothers thing and just say no bummers.
No
bummers. Like, we can talk about serious stuff, but stuff that just makes us go, yeah, why are we don't want to talk about this. Like, no. And no, making us talk about Charlie Sheen that one time did not count as a bummer. It drove William nuts, but it wasn't a bummer per se.
I don't remember that.
That's because it was a million years ago. as is the way with us, just after he was in the news for freaking out and talking about Tiger Blood and everything, like once everyone else forgot about it, I think we mentioned offhand how we enjoyed not talking about certain things, and we may have mentioned that Charlie Sheen was one. And so somebody, I genuinely do not remember who, but I'm just going to assume it was Azure Talon, wrote in and made us talk about Charlie Sheen. And we did, a little bit. We're still mad about it.
Okay.
Even though we don't remember it happening.
I don't remember it at all.
Anyway, the hat magically forwards his emails. We read them, talk about them. So we don't talk about them, and then do that until we don't do that anymore, and that's the show. There we go. So I feel that summer might be upon us soon. We are going away for Memorial Day weekend, but looking at the weather forecast, by the time we get back, I might have to close up the house and turn on the air conditioning.
Yeah, it'll probably be pretty hot by then.
I'm pleased to say where we're going, even though it's further south, we're going to my in-laws again. It's going to be cooler this weekend there, so I'm happy about that.
Nice.
Anyway, how's your week been? Did you watch any interesting movies recently, perhaps? Oh, you haven't watched it yet, have you?
Watched what?
The thing I texted you about.
Oh, the Shazam movie?
Yeah.
Yeah, we did watch it.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
It's amazing that it took that many clues for you to remember that you watched a movie like 2 days ago.
For me to remember you mentioning a movie and what the movie was, that's what it took a while.
Oh, you've just watched so many that you didn't know what I was
getting. No, I just forgot that you texted me about it.
The day HBO Max turned into Max, I was on there and they immediately threw up Shazam Fury of the Gods. And I was like, ooh, I'm not watching that. But I wasn't sure if you knew. And so I told you.
I didn't know. Thank you for that. And we did watch it. It was,
yes.
Boring, which was very disappointing because, I mean, I thought, you know, I mean, Helen Mirren, I mean, come on. I mean, it's not that she did a bad job or anything. It's just,
if you don't got anything to work with, you don't got anything to work with.
Yeah, it just wasn't, I couldn't quite put my finger on what was so boring about it, actually. But Abby thought that it was too, there was almost no story to it. It was just like a whole bunch of strung together gags, you know.
Ah,
it was mostly just trying to be funny, you know.
Yeah, I feel like they learned the wrong lessons from the first Shazam in a way.
Yeah, probably that is it. I mean, there wasn't anything about it that seemed expressly bad in terms of its film craft or anything like that. It just was simply not engaging. Nothing interesting was happening. You weren't allowed to really care much about any of the characters. I think I spent the whole film, and it's over 2 hours long, waiting for something to happen that I could care about, and nothing happened. I mean, things happened, but
nothing that you cared about. Yeah.
No, they just,
I've seen movies like that.
Just events on the screen, and you just feel like the screenwriter forgot to show up or forgot to like, maybe they put in some story beats and then forgot to tell the story between the beats or something.
Just had to do a find and replace for the words Black Adam, but then they read it and they're like, this makes no sense now. So then they just had to throw something together.
Yeah, it was, it was definitely paint by numbers, go through the motions kind of thing. And you just thought, wow, what a waste of talent and money and special effects and everything. And you know, the fundamentals of the story, I mean, when it started, I thought, this is actually an interesting direction. Like, if this were in a comic book, I would think, oh, this will be a fun read. But then, you know, like none of the things that you're probably anticipating mentally about why it would be good, none of those things happen or anything them.
I do feel like I told you at the time that the villains in this made up for this, not from the comics. Mm-hmm. And I don't know, because when they do pull stuff from the comics, mostly people complain how they got it wrong or whatever, or really weird shit that nobody understands happens. And the comic readers are like, oh yeah, no, that's because the comics are weird. But I do feel like the fact that this one wasn't like that probably had an impact on it.
Maybe. I mean, again, to me, the premise was strong. Like every time it came back up, the basic premise in the story, I thought, oh, there's that cool premise again. What are they going to do with it? Oh, nothing. Okay. You know, and it's like, wow, you guys, I still think it's a cool idea. I still think if someone could go back in time and talk to the script writer and say, you need to really beef this up.
Different superhero.
Yeah, you're
I don't think Shazam can do that.
Nah, well.
Can he go back in time?
That'd be cool. But it's a really good elevator pitch, but then they just leaned on that like that was all they needed, and that's too bad, because I think it could have worked, but it didn't really.
Well, the good news is you'll never have to think about it again.
I thought Black Adam
dead before it released.
I thought Black Adam could have worked, but then didn't. So that's another thing related to Shazam, that like this whole Shazam thing that they're doing. The first film wasn't the strongest, but it was okay. If Black Adam and this film had lived up to what I think their basic story premise potential was, all those three of those movies would be really good. But something happened to both of these films where the story was lost and people were focusing on, I don't know what.
Yeah.
Studio drama or something? I don't know.
Well, and that's I think this film was dead before they finished making it. And so it's possible either that there were things that they would have done to fix it that they didn't bother, or in a lot of movies, like when it's finishing, they're like, this is not coming together. And so you quickly do reshoots and bring in new people and stuff like that. And maybe again, they were just like, why bother?
It's not going anywhere. You make a good point.
Because people don't think in movies anymore. They think in cinematic arcs.
Right. But also, as you and I have said many times, and I'm certain it's true, the storytelling really happens in the editing bay. And that means that the film can often be done several times. Like, okay, it's done, guys. Tell me what you think. And they don't like it. So you take another shot at it. And that's why you do have things like reshoots and stuff. People make a big deal of those in the news these days, but they've been around forever. And you could be right. It could be that this was a thing that in previous times people would have watched it and said, well, you guys are almost there. Let's try it again. And they would have had a chance to fix it. But there were actually Black Adam and this film have two things in common.
Little lightning bolt symbol.
The first thing I already mentioned, which is the premise seemed strong to me. The elevator pitch seemed very strong. But the second thing is the confidence of their lead actors. Dwayne Johnson was absolutely confident that this film was going to kill it and was going to become the thing that defined the rest of the DC cinematic universe. And Zachary Levi was the same.
Yeah.
He was really confident that this was going to be such a huge hit, and it was really going to help define where the DC cinematic universe was going to go.
What? He's still here. Gus is still right here.
Right there. And so why? I mean, I could, based on the elevator pitch, I get it. If they were so in love with the elevator pitch, I can see that because it was good. But the final film was so clearly not worthy of that good premise. How could they have thought that these films were going to do that?
I have seen a lot of things over the years that have brought home the idea that no one, but especially actors, cannot tell while making a movie most of the time if it's good or not. It's what you see is in no way resembles the pattern and pacing of how it was made.
Sure, but I mean, like,
so Dwayne Johnson, just sort of don't know.
But I believe Dwayne Johnson was actually also a producer on it, so he should have known. Yeah. You know,
yeah. I mean, not just he also can just, if you're just real excited. I mean, we're also in an era now where movie stars who are making superhero movies can also be comic book nerds.
Yeah, yeah.
And so if you just love a thing, you know.
I'm, you know, when I was a kid, there was a live action version of Captain Marvel, which he's not Captain Marvel anymore because of lawsuits. There was a live action version that I really liked, and it was paired with Mighty Isis, a live action version of that. Actually, I think the guy that played Billy Batson in that thing I watched as a kid makes a cameo in the movie for a second.
I could believe it. I didn't mention it. A couple weeks ago, we watched Uncharted, finally.
Hmm. Oh, yeah. Which, Nolan North has a cameo in that.
Yes, but I didn't know at the time because I don't know what he looks like. He's a voice actor. But there's the scene and he's there and he's like, what are you? And I'm like, this guy's really, like, this is pointed. This is clearly somebody. Like, this is clearly an Easter egg for someone. So I looked it up and I'm like, oh, I should have guessed. It's the guy who voices the character. By the way, quick thing on Uncharted for anybody who's curious. If you like action movies just for the action, Uncharted is fine. It is okay to watch. It's also okay to skip, but it's fine to watch. If you do not fall into that specific demographic, give it a fucking pass. Jesus. Again, really boring and also made no sense. And also the little few things I actually know about the video games, and I don't know much, like, and I was annoyed at the stuff they did. Oy.
Well, we've played all the video games.
And I bet you were livid.
No, our expectations were pretty low.
I thought ours were too, but I was like, and I mean, the action, some of the action was kind of cool in places.
Oh yeah. But, and looked like the action in the cutscenes of the game. Very much so. The cutscenes of the game are very much like what was in the movies. And so that was,
well, in some cases kind of fun. Directly.
Yeah. But I mean, the rest of it, you know, why even call it an Uncharted movie with all the things that were so different, but whatever. I mean, when you're a video game fan, which I think Abby's more of a video game fan than I am, but with her, I'm a video game fan. And a couple things happen when it comes to movies. One, it's just like with if you're a fan of fiction and books, you don't necessarily want the book to become a movie because it's perfectly fine in a book. So a lot of these video games, perfectly fine in video games, making them into movies doesn't even make sense to a video game player. But there's the other side, which is, gosh, I love these characters, and wouldn't it be cool to see them up on the big screen or let them get popular out in the culture so that there's even more of it. So you're kind of of two minds of it sometimes. And in the case of this film.
Oh, sorry, go ahead.
I was just going to say, in the case of this film, I think it did okay.
I think we might actually get a sequel. I think it might have made enough money.
And if that means more, you know, if that comes back and helps the games, there's more games or there's more merchandise from the games or something. Well, I mean, I think a lot of people who like the games will like that.
Right. I to your point, I still remember the chill of excitement and the hairs on my arm standing up when I first saw the trailer for the Watchmen movie. And it was one of my first experiences of like, oh my God, I read a comic book and now it's like they're real. Similar vibe when I had Pacific Rim, because it was like, all of my childhood TV shows, but it's like, what if they were real? And I mean, and that movie stank real, real, real bad and actually made me angry for years. So you never can tell. But that moment of just like, oh, the things that were in my head, are they? So cool.
Yeah. Yeah, that is.
But that don't mean it's going to be good.
No. So yeah, I like when Harry Potter was first being made, I think people felt like, gosh, you know, on one hand, the books are fine. I don't want to sully them with a TV show or a movie. But on the other hand, I'd love to see the, you know, Hogwarts Castle. I'd love to see all these things. I think eventually the films worked out for most Harry Potter fans, but there was some people were worried about it for a long time.
Part of the reason I did the intro joke I did is that's happening with Harry Potter.
What is?
They are rebooting the Harry Potter book series as a TV show.
Oh, yeah, I heard
with
that.
With new cast members.
Yeah,
the same that. Story, not something else in the Harry Potter universe. The story of the books as a TV show with new people.
I think I even heard that because they're doing it as a streaming show and they have more time to tell the story, that they intend to try to be as true to what the books were like as possible and include as much of what the books.
Well, and may need to even add more things depending on how long the seasons are.
Add it up a little bit. That'll be interesting to see what they do there.
Not there for that, but that's.
Well, I'm not either. I've never been a Harry Potter fan, but who knows?
All right. Other than watching boring movies, how's your week?
It's just school's pretty intense for the last 4 weeks here. So last night I was working late while Abby went and saw the kids and stuff. I had to stay here and work. So it's just been mostly that for me. How about you? How's your week been?
I don't know. Let's find out.
Oh, the list. Didn't you always have a list? You just kept it in your head?
I mean, kind of, but that was not very effective. And now that I have a physical one, I very deliberately forget what I've done in the week.
But you've had a phone to do this with pretty much the whole time we've been podcasting.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. Okay.
Yeah, there isn't a jump in technology that started this to happen. Like, finally. Finally, modern technology has caught up with my desire to take notes. No.
Okay, I never mind.
Finished Horizon Forbidden West, 107 hours.
Wow.
By the end. And I may go back in and do some of the side stuff and things because there's things to do and the world's very pretty and the gameplay is pretty fun. But I had to explain this to my wife because I got very frustrated that it was still going. And I said, like, this will probably be my last open world game for a while and stuff. But it's still my favorite series. And it's my favorite series for the story. It is. I mean, the gameplay is good and I like it, but that just makes me like it. This is my favorite series for the story. It is so creative. It is, in my opinion, a much more hopeful post-apocalyptic story than most any other one you find. I realized through this one, which is, you know, a continuation and all that, it shows a model of moral pressure that I actually buy into in a way that virtually no story that tries to enter in a moral component does. Like, this, the reasonings of our protagonists and things make sense to me. I was also fascinated because certain outlets, when it came out, said the main character this time around is really boring and shitty and they did terrible characterization. I don't know what happened. And it made me nervous. And I asked a friend who had already played it. I'm like, did you see that? And they're like, nope, seemed like the same character to me as before. And I actually thought it was really great characterization. Now, the character is very stoic and the character has to make a lot of growth. Like, the character has some flaws that it that she overcomes through the thing. But I nailed it. I mean, I thought they nailed it. I don't know how much I'm projecting or how much the people who didn't like it are projecting or what. So I don't fault anybody for not liking this. This is clearly very something personal to me, but I loved the story very much. I was a little sad. Lance Reddick's character, we did something that I thought would essentially write the character out, and I was like, that is handy for the next game since he's dead. Right. But then we didn't. And now I'm like, oh, we're going to have to do some stupid shit. We're like, oh, yeah, he got blowed up off screen between games. And,
yeah.
But, you know, you can't play around that. Speaking of which, RIP Tina Turner. 83. Not bad. Yeah. All right. So I finished Horizon Zero Dawn. I also have almost finished Dredge. Which is a game I have been very excited about.
Oh, I don't know. I don't think you've talked about it.
It is a relatively new game. It would be best described as a Lovecraftian fish simulator.
Are
you, I love how you're like, that makes sense. That tracks as a
you are a fisherman or you're a fish or. How does I'm not following, I don't think.
You are a fisherman.
You are, okay.
And in traditional silent protagonist style, you have crashed, your ship was ruined and wrecked on the things, and you wake up in this small fishing village without much memory of your past, but you're fishermen, and they need a fisherman. And so they're going to give you a boat, and you fish and sell your fish, and some of it will go to pay off the boat. And but unlike, say, Animal Crossing, where you pay it off pretty quick, and then you just have a boat and you just do things, and you go fishing, and it's fishing similar. Like, you have a boat and you go and you catch fish, and there's little mini games to catch fish, and then you go back and you sell them, and you can buy better fishing equipment and improve the boat and add extra things on the boat and things like that. And then one day, you catch a fish that's really fucked up. Not necessarily a specific one, but while you're fishing, you will eventually catch a fish that, like, oh, this one has 7 eyes. That's, it's exactly the same as the other one, except it's got 7 eyes. What the crap? And so you go back to sell it, and the fishmonger's like, ooh, I'll pay extra for this. He's like, really? All right. So then, and then mysterious stranger comes up to you and is like, I know what you found. Come see me on this island. And he sets you on a quest. And it's a very dark Lovecraftian story that goes on. But the whole time you are still fishing and like trying to catch all the different kinds of fish and upgrade your boat and get cooler equipment and research to unlock better equipment and things like that. And it's really good. It's really good. If Lovecraftian style stories appeal, and if, you know, they call them what, the Hairy Dad games, basic simulators where the whole deal is you do your job and then you upgrade to do your job better and things like that. If those two kinds of things appeal to you, they do it perfectly here. It's wonderful. I am almost done with it. I am not done with it because the story is intense near the end and I kind of know where it's going to go. And I'm like, I don't know. I haven't gotten to an evening where I'm like, yeah, I'm ready for this emotional ride, but I've gotten to the end point. And actually there are multiple endings and I've gotten to the end points for all the paths I want. And I have it on good authority. You can go back because you don't ever manually save. But I have it on good authority that once you end one version, you can go back to just before you decided and like do it again. Cause I definitely want to try them all out and I want to play afterwards cause there's more fish to find and stuff like that. Lots of side quests and crap.
More fish to fry. Huh?
More fish to fry. No, my fish to find. fish. Plenty of fish in the ocean. But I started it on last Friday, and I'm almost done. And part of that is it's a kind of short game, but more of that is I have just been playing the shit out of it nonstop. The base gameplay loop is so addicting, and the story is so interesting. And you get little bits and pieces. You run into different NPCs, and they tell you things, and you find out the history of the islands around here, and things changed 20 years ago, and nobody knows why. Da, 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 da. All standard, you know. It's set in a fictional place, but it's very, you know, New England fishing village kind of thing going. it's just great. I really like it. So I would recommend it. It's relatively new. I actually decided to pay full price because I had just seen some reviews that just made it look amazing. So I really enjoyed that. All right, that's enough video game talk. Now let's talk shows and movies. Last night, we started watching the first half of the two-part, like almost four-hour-long documentary George Carlin's American Dream. It is a documentary detailing George Carlin's life. It's, if you are at all a comedy geek and if you are at all interested in George Carlin, I recommend it. It's not a perfect documentary, and in some ways it gets a little hero worshipy, but it has the material. Like, you find it shows the warts and all. It just seems to sort of lean a little more sympathetic than I think is fair, but like, it's fascinating. George Carlin is one of those few people who has had a career spanning decades in which he reinvents himself over and over again. It comes out very differently, and it's really interesting to see that. And because we were talking about like which George Carlins do you know, like the one we grew up with, and that was a thing, and then but you hear about others, and it's just really interesting. And I mean, there's some shitty stuff in there. He was had some definite problems and did some not great stuff, but there's also really cool stuff and lots of innovative. Of course, he innovated a whole lot of things. He's created a couple different kinds of comedy, and his history goes, he was born in 37, 39. He was born somewhere in the late 30s. So he was around for fucking ever. And it's really interesting. So I would recommend that. Have you messed around with Max at all yet? Other than watching a boring movie?
Not really. I mean, we've looked to see if different things are offered, or if similar things are offered as compared to other services we've subscribed to. Like Discovery, somehow I'm going to mess it up if I try to talk about it. But it's like we were just subscribed to Discovery and HBO Max both, because even though Discovery acquired HBO Max, they had different services or they offered different things.
Yeah.
I think that's what it was. So then one of the first things we wanted to do, of course, was to see, all right, did they fix that? So now we don't need both of these services. I think that's one of the things that Abby did.
That's essentially why they did this, as near as I can tell.
Yeah.
Max is now all the stuff that was on HBO Max and all the stuff that was on Discovery Plus.
Right.
In general, I have not given a shit about Discovery Plus, because to me, Discovery, along with TLC and all the others, are now just like, hey, here's teen moms having emergency room things while panning for gold. And like, just bullshit pseudo reality TV that I don't give a crap about. But I was a little excited because the Try Guys, back when there were four of them, did they have a popular segment they've done over and over again called Without a Recipe. And they did a TV show that was a whole season of them traveling around the country and doing it. And you couldn't see it on YouTube, obviously, because Discovery paid them to do it. It was only on Discovery Channel and Discovery Plus. So I couldn't see it. And now I'm like, maybe I could see it. And I went to look and I can see it. And that's great. But I also found out a long time ago in Discovery's acquisition of cable channels and things, they got Food Network. So, and I used to watch a lot of Food Network. And now it's all back again. Oh. All the old ones I loved are there. Good Eats is there. Chopped is there. Iron Chef America is there. Diners, Drive-Ins, and Dives. All of these old Man versus Food. And I can watch them again. I'm so excited. I love those shows. So I'm pretty happy about that. Anyway, last thing I want to talk about watching things. I started watching She-Ra.
Really?
Yes.
What do you think of it?
I really like it. Way more than I even expected to.
Oh, wow.
When it first came out, I didn't really care. I was like, oh, that's interesting. But I didn't watch the He-Man one either, whatever. And I had friends who really liked it. But they are friends that, in my opinion, their viewing things are very similar to a one-issue voter. So, like, She-Ra, I don't want to spoil things, but She-Ra had this one thing, and so they loved it. And I'm like, yeah, it's great that it has that one thing. That will not sustain a TV show for me.
Right.
And I was like, eh. But lately, I've been trying to come up with TV shows for me to watch by myself. Because sometimes in the evenings, I'm bored, and I try and find a movie, and I can't always find a good movie or whatever. And so I'm like, I should get more TV shows. I spend a lot of time at home by myself. I can watch these things, whatever. And then I happened to watch a thing, of a YouTube video unrelated, in which one of the hosts, it was from several years ago, and one of the hosts had started watching She-Ra and was talking about the things they liked about it. And I was like, I should check that out. And especially because it's a children's show. I mean, it's rated TV Y7, and I'm like, it's probably not gonna be too heart-wrenching for me. And I like that. I don't like the shows that are not, or I'm sick of all the dark bullshit, and I'm like, this won't be that. I don't know what it'll be, but it won't be that. And so I just started watching, and at first I was like, this is easily digestible. The episodes are short. It's pretty straightforward, but as I am watching it more and more, I'm really, really liking it, and I've been trying to figure out why. And I think the biggest thing is it's novel in a very specific way that I find very refreshing. The big one is most of the characters are female presented. It's a standard kids fantasy cartoon, but just like most of the characters are women. And it's just nice. Like all the old shows I used to watch had the token girl in the group. This show has the token boy. And they're all characters. And just random characters that show up, most of them are women. Some of them are guys. But it's very similar to how I'm trying to do in my books, where it's like, every once in a while I put in a guy, but for the most part, I try and put female characters in ratios similar to where you would run into male characters elsewhere, which is to say 80 to 90% of them.
Sure.
And
sure.
This show is doing it. It also is, it has a well-crafted story. It's very clearly a kid's show. And there are certain things that annoy me because they're kid's shows. And so you have to gloss over things, or you have to, there are certain character arcs that I can already see where they're going, partially because I've seen shows like this before, and partially because I have some spoilers into how the series goes. And I'm being frustrated with how slow and obtuse those are going so that they can stretch them out. But it's a kid's show, and it makes sense. But they're doing worse. There are characters whose bodies are not shaped in the standard superhero way every cartoon has them, and it's not a plot point. It's not ever in fact mentioned. This person just looks a little different in a way that's very realistic for a human to look, but that you would never see a human look in a cartoon like this. And just it's not at all talking down. I know already it's got established character. The show is done, and it had 5 seasons, and it resolved as far as I understand. And I can see we're already building stories. It's very clearly not for someone my age or someone my generation. It's got very strong Gen Z energy to it.
Mm.
But I still appreciate it. And it's not blowing my mind, but I'm just enjoying it. Just having a good time with it. So I'm like, I just started a couple days ago and I'm like six episodes in. I've decided I'm not doing the one episode a day thing. I'm trying to ease up on that idea I have in general. That's for when a show is something that I need to process and think about and that I really want each episode to stick with me. Then I do it one day at a time. I can sleep in between. But this one is fine and it's not hard to follow. And I don't spend a lot of time debriefing afterwards. So it's fine. But yeah, I'm really enjoying it a lot.
Yeah.
At least about that. You guys watched it long ago, right?
Mm-hmm.
And you enjoyed it?
Mm-hmm. Yep. Abby loved it, for sure.
Yeah.
I thought it was fun. Like you said, it's made for kids, but it's definitely not, it's not one of those things that's made for kids and it's only, like, only made for kids to the extent that parents in the room are going to be super annoyed by it, like Teletubbies or something like that.
And it's got an overarching plot. I don't think you could easily watch. I mean, you could, but the story takes place from episode to episode to episode, in interesting ways. But I'm just, and it took me an episode or two to realize that what was going on. But just like most of the characters are women, mm-hmm. It's such a simple thing, and it's in the same way that we all grew up with shows where most of the characters were men and kind of didn't notice because that's just what was normal. And then if you point it out, you're like, oh, yeah. And this one, I was like, the good guys and the bad guys, there's only two men. One is the token man amongst the good guys. And the other was the main villain of the bad guys. And I'm like, this is an established IP.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a male in that, so that, and he's not a particularly big part at this point. He's off in the distance telling his underlings to do things, but just random characters are showing up for an episode, like, oh, we got this person in this one, and it's just a woman for no reason, which I'm like, awesome, that doesn't happen.
The voice performances are really good.
They are like, and I looked up a couple of them because some of them I was like, do I know? Because it sounds, these are good voice actors. And I'm getting feels for the characters. There's definite, the token boy character is the comic relief. And I was like, oh, when it's a token girl character, they're usually the brainiac or whatever. But I was like, yeah, it would be weird if the smart one was the one dude, so maybe that's better. But also, although he is the comic relief, I'm getting into him, and he's also displaying a great deal of wisdom in stressful situations that I appreciate. He's goofy, but he also is very insightful in useful ways. And I mean, they are doing the whole, like, every episode there's a lesson we learn, and it's real obvious because in the first act somebody says something blatantly ridiculous and then later they find out they were wrong. I just had one recently where they had this new invention and somebody was like, yeah, that's useless, that would never come in, why would we ever? And I'm like, oh, so that's gonna save the day then. And guess what, it did. But they're good lessons, and they make sense within the context of both the story and the establishment of the characters. It was, the first couple are very clunky because we have to sort of get us to our start point. And it was paced weird, but I was glad because I was like, we all know where this is going to go. Let's just get it over with. And we did. And now we're chugging along. But yeah, digging it a lot. And it's all sitting on Netflix, people. And also, He-Man's not in it. He-Man is not mentioned, at least not in any part in the beginning.
I was kind of interested in these creators taking a shot at He-Man, actually, like having us doing something with He-Man in relation to what they built here. I was very interested to see what that would be, but I don't think that's ever going to happen.
So. I'm curious. A little bit. So they did a He-Man, not these people, but Netflix did a He-Man show recently.
Right.
And it was very polarizing.
I didn't watch it.
Well, apparently it was very polarizing because it really sort of tackled the tropes and dealt with, like, it dealt with some of the things that happen as trauma and how they would have emotional impact and things, which certain people were like, wow, this is really like breaking down and deconstructing this kind of mythos, and it's cool. And other people were like, you're making He-Man into, he sucks now. So it's very polarizing. But when some people are saying the one thing and other people are saying the other thing, I'm like, this sounds like something I would be interested in. So I may check that out at some point, but for now I'm here with this. But there aren't, weirdly, the episode, the each season has drastically different numbers of episodes. Like, yeah. The first season is like 13, and there's at least one episode season in there that only has like 6, and so I don't know. So I think I'll be getting through it pretty quick, but we will see. Anyway, we are almost out of time. We should do an email. So do an email.
Okay.
No, you.
See,
don't stop. We're finally going to hear from our listeners. That's so rude. I love you. Don't worry about him.
The subject line says from ChatGPT.
Oh my god, GPT! I thought it was GPT.
It, I think it is, but
maybe he's being funny
as a joke.
Oh, hat. Okay, I don't know what GPT stands for, so
I don't either.
Good one.
Azure Talon, and he signs it Azure Talon from ChatGot.
All right. You skipped the middle.
I know, I'm going to read it. How do cultural differences impact the way that people experience and express emotions, and what can we learn from studying these differences? Wow, if he didn't really get that.
I mean, yeah.
That's a
dead-on impression.
Oh, yeah. That's like, if he made it up, like, this sounds like a question AI would come up with. He is exactly right. That's amazing. Wow. That's amazing. But anyway, how do cultural differences impact the way that people experience and express emotions? And what can we learn from studying these differences?
I think we've talked about this before, or you may be familiar with this. I don't know. Different cultures have different numbers of colors that they recognize.
Mm-hmm.
Like, there are some cultures that only recognize black and white, and everything we would see are shades of either black or white. And it's not that they're seeing in black and white. They're just like, this red is a shade of black, you know, and this yellow is a shade of white. But with a few notable exceptions that often make sense in geographic context, there's an order to it. If your culture only recognizes two colors, it is largely black and white. If it is three colors, I believe the third one is red. And there's a set order. It completely separated cultures. If they have only five colors in their lexicon, it's the same five colors.
Yeah, it's usually, yeah.
I can't help but think there's probably a similar translation with emotions.
I mean, you... researchers argue about this all the time, of course, right? I mean, you've got researchers who insist that if you take pictures of a human face that's supposed to express a certain emotion, and you go to anywhere on the planet, the response is going to be so similar. There's going to be small differences, but they're so similar that for these researchers, as far as they're concerned, they're universal. But other researchers will insist, but you just said small differences. What are those small differences? And why do you call them small? Maybe they're big. Maybe you don't know, you know? So there's a lot of disagreement about that.
And I mean, I can't speak for other cultures or other people even, but there are plenty of facial expressions that are expressing emotions that I would have a hard time defining.
Right.
And that's the big thing is, we as individuals experience emotions that we have a hard time defining. And so it's insane to think that every culture is going to define them the same if every individual can't get that shit together.
Well, but also like, there's questions about what would you even mean by emotions. There are some researchers that would insist that it means a particular neurochemical. Well, we do know all humans have that neurochemical. So does that mean they all have that same emotion? Well, that seems to be an absurd thing to think. Some people would say it's a certain neural pattern or whatever. We all know human beings have neural patterns, and they might even have that neural pattern. But is it always interpreted the same way by every culture? Clearly not. So it's emotions are a thing that, you know, since I started this program, one of the things I've been thinking about is, well, how would I take symbolic interaction that I learned when I was an undergraduate? What would a clinical practice of that science look like? Because as far as I know, nobody's ever done that. And one thing you have to deal with when you're thinking about how a clinical practice would work is you have to think of, well, how do you deal with emotions? Like, do you even acknowledge that there is such a thing? And if you do, well, how are you defining it? How are you going to name them? How are you going to interact with someone about emotions? And that's been the hardest thing. I mean, there are other things you have to think about, like developmental stages and things like that. But the very hardest, and what's the self and how do you define that? All that stuff's pretty easy from a symbolic interaction standpoint. But the real problem has been emotions. Like, what are we going to do with that? And it's not that you can't find symbolic interactionists, even people who were Carl Couch's students like I am. You can find them writing about emotions and things. But it's really complicated, convoluted even in some cases. And so, you know, from my perspective, as someone who's actually been thinking about this very thing quite a lot, it's really hard to answer this kind of question without being so specific about terminology and defining things so specifically that you eventually get to the point where everything you're saying applies only to what you're talking about, only to you, and it can't really be generalized in a way that this question is.
Yeah. And this is you're putting in my head now this idea that I actually think the term, the category emotions, is pretty arbitrary.
Yeah, it kind of is.
Because what I was going to say first is I'm guessing most cultures, because they are integrated hormonally and physiologically and all sorts of things, have the same building blocks. I'm guessing everybody has happy, sad, angry, afraid,
or something that's close enough to that. Yeah.
Yes. But types of those things, or when you get into nuance, concepts of guilt, concepts of pride. And then you get into ones like, is boredom an emotion? Yeah, let's say for a moment that it is.
Yeah.
So if I say I'm feeling boredom, you have a thought of what you think I'm saying. But what if I tell you instead I am feeling ennui? Technically, I think sort of the same thing. Or the one that I consider very critical. If I tell you I'm sad, that's a thing. You have a rough idea there. If I tell you I'm melancholy, that, to me at least, elicits a very specific and unique type. A subset of sad, I guess I would say, but
I was just reading an article the other day where it's an existentialist therapist, and he's talking about how there's a difference between existential depression and other types of pathological depression.
Which
I thought was interesting. I'm sure some people would argue that all pathological depression is existential depression. Some would argue that this existential mumbo jumbo is garbage and has nothing to do with clinical practice. So there's a lot of debate about that kind of thing.
And pensive, as opposed to, say, thoughtful, apprehensive, anxious versus stressed. And I remember my mind got blown when I learned in school that there can be good stress and bad stress, eustress and distress. But it's all stress.
Anxious versus excited. which some people would argue the only difference between those two is perspective. They're exactly the same in every other way. It's just your perspective on it is different.
And there's a lot of languages, particularly in Europe, I've found that there's a lot of the Germans, especially because the Germans are like, we need a new word. Let's just grab the seven we like and stick them together. But there are a lot of languages that have terms for a specific kind of emotion that is triggered by a specific situation. So it's not just you're sad, but it's the kind of sadness you would feel from loss, or the kind of sadness you would feel from that born out of fear, or something like there are already languages that narrow it down even more. And unlike, we all like to play the game. I mean, we've all played the game, but what if, I mean, most of us when we're high, but I suppose other people too, like, what if, how do I know that when I see red, I'm seeing the same thing you're seeing, dude? And the answer is we don't. However, we both agree this is red or burgundy or what. But the point is, it may look different to you, but we can ignore, we're talking about this thing. If I say this color, this is a thing. We can't do that if I'm like, that feeling you're feeling right now, that specifically, let's talk about that. How the hell would I know? People go their whole lives not understanding their own emotions or other people describing their emotions or denying their emotions. People don't go around being like, never really gotten blue. What is blue?
Well, they did.
Or like living in denial. Like you've been saying, actually, I do know people who live in denial that something is one color when it's the other. But those people are broken in an irreparable way. Like, we can't and we never will be able to nail that down.
Right. But not only can we talk about understanding our emotions as a thing, do we understand them or do we not? But we can talk about what it means to understand anything, much less our emotions. Our verbal communication and a lot of our thought is verbalized, is a digitization of our analog experience. And so therefore it's not going to always feel satisfying in how it captures that experience. And also it's going to, in where it fails to capture that analog experience, it's going to circle back and try to force a fit, so to speak, which means our language can start to shape how we actually perceive the situation. So it's a strange thing that, I mean, I'm not sure that all sentient beings in the universe are going to have this problem if they don't have to digitize their internal experience like we do.
Potentially. And I mean, that's symbolic communication is our whole deal. And you can have discrete symbols. Again, the red. Like if I say red, that's symbolic. The word is symbolic, but it can be referring to a specific thing that you and I can confirm that's what that is. We have a physical thing. The pigment on this thing is red, and we agreed at that. Emotions are abstracted to the point that it can't ever be done, because, I mean, again, we can look at physiological things, but those are going to vary wildly in a lot of different circumstances and often combine in certain ways and things like that. But because these are abstract and we cannot point at a physical thing and be like, that's what that word means. It also cannot, the abstract symbols cannot be removed from culture. Uh-oh. We cannot talk about abstract symbols outside of cultural context.
No.
Which means emotions, definitions of emotions are built out of cultural context. Now, the question that maybe is unanswerable, is the experience of emotions culturally context specific? I would still say probably yes, in that every culture not only has definitions of emotions, they have judgments about those emotions.
Sure, it gets
when
backwards.
They are appropriate, when they are not, and when you should, right. When it's weird to feel it versus when it's you're supposed to feel it.
Again, there's also that aspect of how verbally. I mean, symbols don't have to be verbal. They don't have to be.
No.
They don't have to be digitized. They don't have to be verbal language. But we do take our experiences and digitize them in that way, and so therefore. We do culturally, because language is built on some, all languages are built on a similar scaffolding, as Noam Chomsky's pointed out. But after that scaffolding, it's all cultural. Culture fills in all of that. And that circles back and informs a little bit how we think about what our internal states are doing. So our subjective experiences aren't just bubbling up from the bottom. We're responding to them, we're doing things to them, we're digitizing them, we're behaving out in the world, and all that comes back and influences. So there's this feedback loop going on, and it's our consciousness ultimately isn't caused by simply by our neurology. Our consciousness emerges as this feedback loop from our interactions, and it doesn't have a single cause. But what that means is that consciousness is made up of a lot of cultural artifacts, both solid like this computer and not solid like our ideas of things. So there is going to be a component of how we think about emotions. Well, for example, we're going to value and prioritize emotions in a different way. Like let's say every culture has happiness, but not every culture prioritizes happiness in the same way. And because of how they prioritize it, if you interact with them, you might have a hard time even finding happiness in their culture because of how they prioritize it.
Pride and shame are real good examples of ones that you can very clearly see in different cultural contexts, be modern ones even, how those are held up. And then it quickly ties into relational things and the acts you're supposed to do within your relationships and the emotional impact that has and whether or not it's appropriate to acknowledge or not. There are plenty of cultures where certain emotions are expected and normal, but talking about having those is not, things like that. But yeah, I mean, and we all have seen it's super liminal that how our environment influences our emotional state. I mean, to the degree that now we have studies like mimetics and social engineering and things like this. And our environment is hugely cultural. It's almost entirely cultural. Like that, yeah. So, yeah. Very much so. And we have now exhausted the level of research I like to do and discussion I like to do into these kind of things. So, yes. And now I will never think about this again. The George Carlin documentary. I'm really. I told you, like, there are some bad things he did or whatever, and they talk about that. Those are mostly filtered through two things. One is his daughter is in the documentary and actually helped produce it. And a lot of the stories of the bad things involve her telling them, mostly because a lot of them happened to her. Both her parents were pretty fucked up in various times. But also from George Carlin, from archival footage of interviews and things at the time. So the level of bouts of complete cluelessness and bouts of self-awareness going back and forth, I find very fascinating. And in particular, I found it interesting in the late 60s, early 70s, he was very at the forefront of drug culture and described drugs and our society, American society's view of drugs and the various hypocrisies that lie in and how drugs permeate our culture, even because we say like, oh, drugs are bad, but then we constantly have all sorts of medications that we're all encouraged to take all the time for everything. And he had such a brilliant insight into drug use and drug culture and simultaneously exploded his life through drug abuse. And it's really fascinating to see those two things happening simultaneously. And George Carlin, to me, now that I'm watching this, is very much an example of one of those great conflicting things inside. The classic, and again, to use a comedian, the one that I always put up when I'm talking about disparate thoughts and holding them in your head at the same time is the Bill Cosby was a brilliant and innovative comedian in the beginning. Later, hard to say. He also said some things later in life that described maybe a lack of touch in a way that he wasn't out of line before. And throughout all of this, while all of these things are happening consecutively, he appears to have been doing a lot of rapes. And I feel very strongly about these things in different ways.
Right.
They can still all be true in one person.
Right. Yep.
And George Carlin has a lot of that, because seriously, there's a lot of he seriously did reinvent himself over and over again for a variety of reasons and completely transformed how his work did. And in the process, in multiple cases, transformed the way we look at comedy and stuff. And it's just really interesting. And it's a great example of that kind of thing. Anyway, we're over time. I gotta go and do some things, but this has been lovely. Thank you for joining us. If you're watching this on YouTube, smash that like button and leave us a comment. Describe your emotions to us. How are you feeling right now after watching this? How does this make you feel? William needs to practice taking notes while people tell him how they feel, so do that. If you're on the blog, talk to us on the blog. Currently, the most activity on the blog is from like an episode that's about a month old and us all discussing roundabouts in staggering detail, but I'm having a fun time with it. But you go on the blog, talk about this. I am real late coming to She-Ra. I'm guessing a lot of listeners have watched it. What's your view on it? Please don't spoil anything for me, but love to have your take on it. I'm also guessing there's some George Carlin fans out there. Have any of you played Dredge yet? Some of you are bigger video game heads than me. Have you been playing that? Anyway, just tell us things. We like things. And also write us. Email the hat, themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. It is our lifeblood. I tune in next week and see what the weather is then, because that's the real reason you listen. Also, oh, God, okay, in the comments. Cast us. Cast the reboot. Who's the young Tony and the young William? I really want to see this. Like, get on this. I'm excited. I want people to read. Who is my Gen Z equivalent? I want to see that. My Gen Z celebrity equivalent. Speaking of which, one of the nibblings, after having watched a recent episode, one of the princesses in She-Ra, I'm like, oh my God, that's them. And I'm going to have to text them and be like, I think I figured out where you got your entire personality. You're just this person, aren't you? And I'm not even positive they've seen the show, but like, it's so them. It's amazing. Hashtag princess goals.
Yet another mystery solved by the hosts of the Magical Talking Hat. Do you have a question that begs to be answered? Then please write the hat at themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. That's themagicaltalkinghat@gmail.com. Also, visit the hat at themagicaltalkinghat.com. The music for this episode was provided by Kevin MacLeod of Incompetech.com.